Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 30th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, pandemic H1N1 and the 2009 Hajj pilgrimage, the contribution of inherited wealth to economic inequality, and the experiences of four Nobel laureates as women in the sciences. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about an animal that doesn't get cancer, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by American Journal Experts, the number one source for science and medical paper editing and proofreading. AJE has over 700 native English-speaking editors in various fields of study. They have helped tens of thousands of authors worldwide. Quality and customer satisfaction are their highest priorities. www.journalexperts.com. Use referral code SCIENCE to receive a 10% discount.
Every year, millions of people travel to Mecca in Saudi Arabia to take part in a pilgrimage called the Hajj. It's the fifth pillar of Islam and so required of each Muslim to make the pilgrimage at least once during his or her lifetime. During the Hajj, pilgrims are often shoulder to shoulder during prayers, routinely touch objects of religious significance, and perform many other rituals that make it very easy for communicable diseases, such as pandemic influenza H1N1, to spread. Given the incubation time of influenza and the sheer numbers of pilgrims present, this year's Hajj presents a possible global health security concern, as returning pilgrims could potentially initiate waves of influenza outbreaks. In a policy forum published online by Science, Shahul Ibrahim, Ziad Mimish, and colleagues outline a series of recommendations they say will help mitigate the transmission burden. Ibrahim works at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, and Mimish is Saudi Arabia's Assistant Deputy Minister for Preventative Medicine. Here first is Saudi Arabia's Ziad Mimish.
I think the age of the pilgrims usually is on the older side. And I think having the pilgrims in a very crowded place, large numbers, and the ritual of the Hajj is very physical. So I think people who have underlying comorbidities tend to have a lot of difficulties with this ritual. So it makes them more predisposed to having respiratory infections and coughing and sneezing, and that will tend to spread the disease more.
Have there been other Hajj-related outbreaks of communicable diseases?
I think in the past there have been many surveys done during the Hajj looking at what infectious complications do occur. And, you know, we have many reports documenting at least 30 to 35% spread of viral upper respiratory tract infections. These are usually mild illnesses. It tends to sort of cause mild disease, and most of the patients or most of the pilgrims recover completely with no problems. I guess this year, because of the concerns about the high level of morbidity with the H1N1, we are quite concerned, and we're trying to be on the alert and be highly prepared.
Are any pilgrims being asked to stay home?
Yes, the Ministry of Health of Saudi Arabia has made recommendations that people who have comorbidities, specifically chronic diseases involving the lungs, the heart, the kidneys, the nervous system, people who are diabetic, pregnant ladies, we're recommending that they delay their pilgrimages to next year or the years after. And also, we said that people who are too young, less than 12 years of age, and over 65, it's better for them to not perform the Hajj this year. But we will not prevent anybody from coming in if they get the approval from their country.
What about when they get there? What screening measures are in place in Saudi Arabia to prevent people with pandemic H1N1 from entering the country and potentially from participating in the Hajj?
Well, the Ministry of Health have invested a lot of resources in being prepared for this Hajj season. We do have a lot of our physicians and health inspectors and public health officers working at all the ports of entry, whether it's seaports or airports or access through roads from different countries with screening mechanisms. I guess if they see any person with symptoms, they will be checked for temperature and then they'll be asked questions and examined. And if they need clinical medical care, they will be provided. We do have cameras or heat sensors in the airports in Jeddah and Medina, and also the seaports in Yanbu and in Jeddah. So anybody who has increased temperature will be, again, assessed by the physicians at the airport and the seaport, and then samples will be taken. There is an area for triage, and there's area for short stay while we wait for the results of the specimens. And then people will be given treatment to ensure everybody is well and taken care of.
At the gathering itself, are there any measures to prevent the spread of the pandemic influenza that might be seen as prohibited by religion?
I don't think so. I think we have made some, you know, common sense and public health recommendations to all the pilgrims to be wearing masks when they're in crowded places. This is not restricted by our religion, and we've had recent fatwas from religious leaders in the last few months saying that this is acceptable to prevent the spread of the disease. We're also recommending that people use alcohol hand rub to sort of cleanse their hands, especially if they're coughing or sneezing, and also to cover their face and mouth when they're coughing and sneezing so they won't spread the disease to others.
Now, the Hajj is still several weeks away at this point. Any possibility of vaccinating enough pilgrims to confer immunity to the community?
Sure. I think the Ministry of Health of Saudi Arabia has made recommendations to all the countries that are sending pilgrims, and these are almost 160 countries across the globe, saying that each country that has the vaccine, we recommend that they do give the seasonal influenza vaccine as well as the influenza H1N1 vaccine. Now, because we know that there are some shortages in vaccine supply, we also know that the vaccine is very expensive and some countries cannot afford to get it. We said countries that cannot access the vaccine, that it would be okay for them to send the pilgrims without the vaccine, and that would be on the country's own responsibility. For us in the kingdom, we are working to secure enough supply of the vaccine to give it to the pilgrims from within the country. So at least we have a good proportion of our pilgrims from inside and outside who are vaccinated, and hopefully that will provide some protection.
In the event of an outbreak, how many healthcare workers, facilities, treatment options are available?
I think the Ministry of Health of Saudi Arabia has an extensive experience in dealing with mass gatherings when it comes to healthcare. And I think there are adequate numbers of facilities. There are actually good numbers of staff available from, you know, all parts of the country who are helping to work during this year's Hajj. As far as resources and supplies, we are very well equipped with having large quantities of medications, masks, you know, ventilators. We have experts who are subspecialists in the field of intensive care, infectious disease, public health. We are working very closely with colleagues and experts who volunteered to work with us during this hot season, experts from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. We have some colleagues from neighboring countries within the Middle East. So I think we're quite comfortable that we are prepared for this year's hot season.
Suppose, again, there is an outbreak of pandemic influenza during the Hajj pilgrimage. What measures would be in place to keep the outbreak from spreading back to the pilgrims' home countries, 160 countries, you said?
I think this is a very good question, and this was discussed in our consultative meeting that was hosted by Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. We invited almost 25 international experts from World Health Organization, from European CDC, from CDC in Atlanta, and from other European countries. And we have discussed this at length. And I don't think there is any way that you can actually prevent the disease from spreading. The disease is already spread across all the countries in the world. And I think the vaccine would be the only thing that would be an extra measure to prevent further spread or sort of more outbreaks. And since we are recommending that the vaccine be given, we are hopeful that the countries that are sending the pilgrims will comply with giving the vaccine. And we think that would be probably the best measure to prevent the spread of the disease outside of the country.
Ziad Mimish, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ziad Mimish is Assistant Deputy Minister for Preventative Medicine in Saudi Arabia. I next spoke with Shahul Ibrahim, who's corresponding author of the paper and works for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Why are you in Saudi Arabia right now?
I am here part of a team from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta on the invitation of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I am leading the epidemiology team here to assist the Saudi government in their preparedness for the Hajj, particularly with the H1N1 pandemic in mind.
Besides the Hajj being the world's largest and most dense gathering of people, what, if any, additional factors are specific to the Hajj pilgrimage and ceremonies that may increase the likelihood of the spread of pandemic influenza?
Well, you know, it is not only that this is a dense gathering, but all the rituals and the activities during this celebration or during this pilgrimage are, you know, everything is kind of counter to or against the principles of social distancing, what we would like to have accomplished during a pandemic. That means, as we have seen in Mexico City early this summer or in 1918 in St. Louis, you close the schools, you prevent people gathering in religious institutions like church or people going to restaurants. And those are activities just to prevent people from coughing on each other or people transmitting the disease. And that is simply not possible here. None of those activities are simply not possible. So that makes it number one. Number two, people are coming from 160 or over 160 countries. And if you look at the countries with major Muslim populations, 19 of the 57 countries were members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference of the OIC are least developed countries, which means their preparedness is very patchy. They do not have access to the vaccines because it has, you know, it hasn't reached even everywhere in the US or the developed countries. They may not have adequate supply of Tamiflu or antiviral medications, and all these things can complicate the situation if the returning pilgrims bring or increase the transmission in those countries.
Given that the Hajj pilgrimage is still several weeks away and the possibility of further vaccinations and things before that time, is it likely that if there is an outbreak of the pandemic H1N1 influenza, that there might be sufficient immunity for the community, the so-called herd immunity, or not?
Actually, we don't have at the moment information on herd immunity because we just got the vaccine, you know, for H1N1. We are just, you know, in the U.S., it is just a few days, you know, since we have, or a week rather, started vaccination. So we have no idea what level of coverage is required to achieve herd immunity. The estimates which has been put forward actually in a paper in Science a couple of weeks ago by Ira Lungini and others, they estimated that you need 70% coverage for the vaccine to be effective in a normal population, you know, not in a mass gathering. And so here, we don't know. In China, they are hoping that they will achieve coverage or immunity with the 30% vaccination, focusing mostly on children. So we don't know what is the story here going to be. And there is no way that vaccine will be uniformly available in all countries to all the pilgrims before they come here. And mind you that a lot of pilgrims already started coming, although the peak arrival is, you know, a few days before the Hajj, but a lot of them come here. Even now, in the next 2 weeks, they start arriving and they start going to the holy places and praying and seeing the country and all those things. So the hope for achieving that herd immunity probably is not going to work.
Are there any steps that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia could be taking but aren't, except for lack of resources, lack of vaccinations, lack of these antivirals? They're already asking for help from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Are they asking for help from others, or?
Oh, yeah, it's a rich country and it is well-resourced, and Saudi Arabia's reputation relies on how the Hajj is conducted, and they take it all the pride and national interest, you know, and the king is, I think, directly responsible for the Hajj. And I think Dr. Riyad Memish has already talked to you probably all about the preparations. I don't think anything is lacking here except the vaccines. They have sufficient supply of antivirals. I don't know about the number because it's in a classified information. I don't have access to that. But what I was told that they have sufficient supplies to treat all the pilgrims if it is needed. Vaccines, you know, nobody can help with the vaccines. You know, there is no country which has adequate supply of vaccines. But besides that, well, they're working with the World Health Organization and they're working with our institution, the NAMRU, that is the Naval U.S. Army Medical Research Unit based in Cairo. And I don't know, there are some other Western universities. So this is for technical collaboration, you know, so that we all talk the same language. We discuss epidemiological activities, the surveillance activities, how best to conduct surveillance. So it is not we are doing something for them. It is we do it in partnership with the Saudi authorities because there are areas which we have some strength and there are areas they have some strength. So we kind of pool all these brains together and make it work. That's all. But otherwise, I don't think they lack anything. But they like to have partnerships. And we have a long history of working with the Saudis, which is, of course, not known to the press because, you know, there was no need. But otherwise, CDC has been, you know, working with the Saudi authorities for several years now, especially with respect to the field epidemiology training program. The main thing is we wish everybody had the vaccine and, you know, then probably we would not have had this conversation, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, and another thing which you have to understand that Saudi Arabia, it is their rule that anybody who gets ill during the process of Hajj, not 2 months before or not 2 months after, but if you are at the Hajj, you fall sick with whatever illness, you break your bone or whatever happens to you, your health care is fully covered, free of cost, irrespective of where you come from, what you are. And they take it seriously. They have, 76 health centers scattered within this area, 7 hospitals in the Mecca area, and then overflow capacity outside in Jeddah. And the same thing in Medina. So they take it seriously, but a lot of things are beyond their control because whatever happens, you know, whoever comes with flu is nothing they can do in all the 160 countries. And also they cannot assure that people won't go home with flu because you don't know who is infected at the time they are departing from the country. So in my opinion, or in our, not only my opinion, our team's opinion and probably world opinion, Saudi has done what they could do to mitigate, because it is prevention, we cannot prevent the pandemic, it's already there. So to mitigate any excess or increase from an expected range of prevalence.
Okay. Shahul Ibrahim, thank you very much.
All right.
Shahul Ibrahim of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is corresponding author, and we also heard from co-author Ziad Mimish of the Saudi Arabian Ministry for Preventative Medicine, talking about their team's policy form, Pandemic H1N1, the 2009 Hajj, and Global Health Security. Find it online, free to download, at www.scienceexpress.org. Scientists already know there's a close link between inheritance and the extent of inequality across modern industrial societies, but in a paper in this week's Science, Monique Borgerhoff-Mulder and colleagues report that link between inheritance and inequality extends to societies that have very different economic systems. The team looked at hunter-gatherers who forage for food, horticulturalists who farm but don't use plows, pastoralists who herd livestock, and agriculturalists who farm extensively and also keep livestock. As to wealth, the team considered the kinds of wealth most important to the societies they studied, that is, relational wealth based on social networks, embodied wealth based on physical or intellectual capacity, and material wealth based on land and livestock. The data comes from the 21 populations the team was aware of for which intergenerational wealth transmission estimates are feasible, and the researchers studying those populations agreed to share data. I spoke with Borgerhoff-Mulder from her office at the University of California, Davis.
The most transmissible by far is the material wealth, and that is, in a sense, not surprising. But what is quite interesting is that this material wealth, so whether it's land or cows or cooking pots or pans or household goods, whatever, these kinds of items are much more transmissible in the agricultural and pastoral societies than they are in the hunter-gatherer and horticulturalist societies. So the answer is a little bit complicated. The material wealth is the most easily transmitted by far, but only in the context of a agricultural or pastoral society.
So the one most transmitted sort of depends on the form of the economic system?
That's the principal finding, really, that material wealth is more transmissible than the other kinds of wealth, but that there's an interaction, that it is greatly more transmissible in the agricultural societies, which really leads us to our primary conclusion, which is that both the kind of wealth, whether it's material, embodied, or relational, or the institutions whereby those wealth types are transmitted, both of these things are really important to the generation of inequality.
is it then our ways of making wealth and what we value that potentially leads to our differences in how we pass on that wealth to our children? Or is it how we pass on wealth to our children that potentially leads to our ways of making wealth and what we value? Or is neither the case and something else is going on?
No, I think that what our analysis shows is that they're both important. The wealth type itself and the institutions, and they both have an independent effect on the transmission and on the inequality. So I don't think we can say from what we've got which drives which. But of course, you know, there's lots of ideas out there. I mean, there's some people who have a very materialist approach to understanding social systems and would try to put the wealth type itself at the kind of base of the explanatory pyramid. And other people come in with a more sort of power differential based set of explanations for differences in economic inequality. But we can't really address that. We can't answer that question, but our data can be used to weigh in on either side of the arguments.
Was it generally the case then that the wealth considered most valuable in each population of people was transmitted from parents to their children? Or at least parents tried to when it was somatic or social connections, things like that?
Yes, exactly. We find that. We find that the kinds of wealth that are most important in a particular population are the ones that show the higher transmissibility. So it does indeed look, and this, of course, is not surprising from an evolutionary standpoint, but it does indeed look as if parents, or maybe it's not parents, but the people who are making decisions about the transmission of wealth are transmitting the kind of wealth that is most important to success in that population to their children.
In which types of economic systems, then, is the disparity between the wealthy and the poor least likely to grow? That is, where the children of rich parents are least likely to be rich or get even richer, or the children of poor parents are least likely to be poor or get even poorer?
The economic systems differ. So our four economic systems, hunter-gatherers, horticulturalists, pastoralists, and agriculturalists, differ in that. The wealth differences that are most marked and that are, so where we have the greatest Gini coefficients, are the agricultural and the pastoral populations. There we find huge differences in wealth.
Gini coefficients being, sorry?
Sorry, a Gini coefficient is a measure of the spread of wealth in a population. And conventionally, these measures have been used just to measure economic disparities. And so if a Gini coefficient is zero, it means everybody owns the same amount. Whereas if the coefficient is one, this means that one person owns everything. And so economists have used this measure a lot to, say, compare different countries, different industrial nations. But we use these coefficients to compare things like hunting success and number of friends you have and household goods, size of livestock herds and things like that. So to carry on answering the question, the Gini coefficients for the farmers, the agriculturalists, and for the pastoralists are extremely high. They're on a par with, for example, the USA of today, whereas the Gini coefficients for hunter-gatherers and horticulturalists are pretty low. They're certainly not zero. There's been quite a lot of discussion in the literature about how hunter-gatherers are very egalitarian, and obviously they're more egalitarian than the other populations we're looking at, but they're by no means equal. There's considerable variation in the amount of wealth, the specific kinds of wealth that are important to them in those populations.
Were there any cases of deliberate egalitarianism where the society is structured in a way that leads to this disparity in wealth, but the institutions require the redistribution of wealth from generation to generation?
Well, that's a good question and definitely an interesting one to address with modern societies where we can look very closely at the kinds of political maneuvering that goes on. With the populations we're looking at, we can't assess that directly. But with the pastoralist populations that I know well because I've worked with them a lot, They are, many anthropologists sort of applaud pastoralists for their sharing institutions, their egalitarian norms. If, for example, a family loses all their wealth in a theft or disease, there are all kinds of institutions whereby relatives and actually neighbors, completely unrelated families or lineages, will provide seed livestock for that family to get back on its feet again. And these institutions are very common across many, many pastoralist populations. So many anthropologists have, in fact, argued there are these kinds of leveling institutions. And indeed, there are. I certainly don't question that. What our analysis found is in that particular case, these leveling institutions, very prominent as they are to an ethnographer working in a population like that, appear to be overcome by the strength of this intergenerational transmission of stock. So this, to me, was somewhat of a surprise to find the very high heritability of material wealth in livestock, because I had, like many other anthropologists, expected that there would be more of a leveling process going on sort of deliberately, as you were asking about.
So even with this kind of leveling that happens in the case of disease or a bad instance, the societies that pass on wealth via livestock are still in a disparity kind of situation that continues on intergenerationally.
Yes, that's exactly the case. And in some ways, I understand why, because when you're working in these kinds of populations, one of the first things you do is first, of course, you read about what everybody else who's worked in that area or with similar populations has done, and you read about all these leveling institutions and these basic principles of egalitarianism and fairness in these populations. So when you first start working in these areas and you get proficient enough in the language that you can talk about such matters, you hear all these kinds of institutions come back to you. People say, yeah, we do this, we help out, we're very cooperative. And indeed, you do see these things happen in the case of a drought, or you see families being helped out with loaner livestock or getting maybe a cow who gives birth to a calf, and then the family can keep the calf and then use that to start off their own herd. So you see these things, but you also see squabbles between families. You know, a generation ago, we gave you, 15 animals because, your great-grandfather or your grandfather had this terrible problem. And the families are still trying to get the cattle back. And so, when you look more closely, there are these institutions of sharing and helping people out, but there's also a lot of clawing back as well. And this doesn't just happen over a year or two. This can happen over the course of a generation. So maybe I shouldn't have been as surprised, given that people have long memories and they remember what they lent and they remember what they're owed back again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Monique Burgerhoff-Mulder of University of California, Davis is lead author of a paper on the contribution of inherited wealth to economic inequality. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Also in this week's issue, a conversation with four Nobel laureates on their experiences as women in the sciences. Science's Jeffrey Mervis and Science Career's Kate Travis spoke with 2009 Nobel Prize winners Elizabeth Blackburn, Carol Greider, Eleanor Ostrom, and Ada Yoneth, and asked them what their success might mean for science and society. Here are a few excerpts from that conversation. First up, and with a reality check, Ada Yoneth, honored for her work in chemistry, says there are many scientists, men and women, who aren't being honored for their work.
There are also many good male that are not being honored. It's just one prize for the whole world. And how the committee in Sweden make the decision is above and beyond my understanding. Yet, I don't think that the gender has to be of any of their consideration. They should make their decisions. Not always they make it the way I would have made, but I wouldn't get gender into these parameters that they look at.
Even so, it's hard not to notice that this is the first year in the history of the Nobel Prizes that more than one woman has been chosen as a science laureate. Eleanor Ostrom, who is being honored for her work in economics, says it may just be a matter of time before women are regularly honored for their work, and that the numbers of women in graduate school in the sciences is a good indication of the change that is coming.
It's still not quite at the level it should be, but you don't make that overnight because taking and getting a PhD is a long process. And if women were not applying or were discouraged from applying, then they have not yet entered in enough numbers to be graduating in enough numbers to be hired in enough numbers to be making major breakthroughs. But it will happen.
At least speaking for the biological sciences.
That's Elizabeth Blackburn, who is being honored for her work in physiology or medicine.
I'm less optimistic that the problem is automatically solving itself, at least in these sciences, and I suspect other sciences too, by just the weight of numbers coming in. What we're seeing is a massive hemorrhaging, if we use the pipeline analogy, at this late stage after all these years of training and, you know, tremendous investment of talent. Then it's going off and sort of getting dissipated in other fields, which is nice for other fields, but not very nice for the aspirations, perhaps, of the women who, you know, really trained and put so much of themselves in training for so many years.
To making it through all those years of training and becoming a scientist, several of the Nobel laureates said it is crucial to identify what you really love to do. Here's Carol Greider, who is also being honored for her work in physiology or medicine.
Do what excites you. Follow your passion. Don't necessarily worry about what obstacles might be there, because there are always ways to overcome them. But the most exciting thing is to be able to do what you love, and just don't let anything stand in the way of that.
And Elizabeth Blackburn adds that women, particularly, but really anyone who adds to the diversity of a scientific team, should be valued precisely because of that diversity.
The point is that any complicated endeavor like science, you need lots of different ways of thinking about things, and women probably do add ways of thinking about things that are scientific, you know, which may be different because of men, because there are cultural differences and so forth. Women bring, you know, a richness to the research in all fields, right, not just science, but women do bring extra dimensions. And so I think this idea that science needs women is really right on target, because I really think it is true that when you have people from different backgrounds, you know, a lot of studies show that if you, you know, have problems and you set a certain group of people who all have the same training and background to solve the problem, they'll all reach this sort of same bottleneck at the same time. But if you have a bunch of different background people, different training, different backgrounds, then they reach bottlenecks at different times. And so the ability to solve complex problems is greatly enriched by having different viewpoints.
You can read more of the conversation in the lead News Focus by Jeffrey Mervis in this week's issue. In the online version, you can hear the whole conversation for yourself. And on the Science Careers blog, Kate Travis summarizes the winner's comments on motherhood and work-life balance. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about an animal that doesn't get cancer. Which animal, Dave?
Rob, the animal is the naked mole rat. You can actually see a picture of this guy on the site. And not only are these animals not very attractive, they're also very unusual in the mammalian kingdom. Even though they're mammals, they are cold-blooded, and they have a social structure much more like ants than other animals. So it's a very unusual creature.
Now, with all these differences between the naked mole rat and us, do researchers still have hope that they'll be able to apply the lessons that they learned from the naked mole rat to potential treatments for us?
Well, they do, Rob. And that's actually because despite all of these differences, the researchers found something that the naked mole rats have in common with us. And what this is it's a genetic pathway that prevents our cells from clumping too closely together. It's a process called contact inhibition. And it works like this, Rob. Say I were to take a bunch of your skin cells and separate them from each other and then lay them down on a petri dish and have them start growing. The cells would grow and grow and grow and divide until they mashed up real tight against each other and they formed this really tight layer. And then they would stop growing. And that's really important because oftentimes what happens with cancer is these cells don't stop growing. They bunch up and they form tumors or these big layers of cells, which can be very dangerous for us. Well, it turns out the mole rats also have contact inhibition, and they use a lot of the same genetic pathways that cells use to sense whether they're too close to each other. But the really important difference researchers found in this study is that the mole rat cells are hypersensitive to contacting other cells. So whereas our cells really have to mash up real tight against each other to stop growing, with the naked mole rat, their cells, as soon as they just touch each other, they stop growing. So they don't even really bunch up that tightly. And the researchers found it's because the naked mole rat cells rely on these two genes to help them sort of sense where their neighbors are. And humans have both of these genes too, but we only really express a lot of one of these genes, whereas the naked mole rat expresses a lot of both of these genes. So they seem to have this extra checkpoint that says, hey, if cells are too close to each other, we've got to stop growing. And the researchers think it's this extra checkpoint that prevents naked mole rats from getting cancer. No naked mole rat has ever been observed with cancer, and they live a long time because of this. They can live as long as 28 years, which for a rodent is a really long time. It's about 7 times longer than a house mouse lives, and it's probably because they don't get cancer.
So if the naked mole rat cells no longer express the products of this gene, they then bunch together like our cells did?
Well, kind of the opposite. What the researchers did was they mutated the cells so that they would grow really close together and bunch up like human cells do. And when they did that, they found a lower level of expression of one of these important genes involved in this contact inhibition. But they never did this on the whole animal level. So they never, for example, did what you suggested and then saw if the naked mole rats got cancer. That would be an important next step. But, you know, all these studies really require a very fundamental knowledge of the naked mole rat genome. And, you know, it seems like almost every day a new species genome is being decoded. And actually, a few researchers have proposed in the past that we also decode the naked mole rat's genome, but it just hasn't been given a high priority, probably because it's such a strange creature. But now with this study, and maybe others like it, there'll be a lot more incentive to fully sequence the naked mole rat's genes.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the genetics of naked mole rats to the genetics of grandmothers and their grandchildren, this next story is about why women tend not to give birth after age 40. Now, that's really unusual in the mammalian kingdom because other mammals reproduce until they die. So taking that into account, our strategy doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Now, men are still fertile long past age 40, so something about grandmothers then.
Well, that's the idea. The question is there some sort of evolutionary reason why human females stop giving birth after about age 40? And researchers have been looking at this question for a long time, over a decade. And one theory that's been proposed is this so-called grandmother hypothesis. And the idea goes like this. Women stop giving birth when they get older because at that point, they can actually be more beneficial to propagating their genes if they take care of their grandchildren. In other words, it's more important at that point, rather than them giving birth to children, to actually ensure that their grandchildren who carry some of their genes live long and prosper. But this has been a really hard hypothesis to test, as you might guess. There's been some evidence in foraging societies in Africa, specifically the Hadza society, that grandmothers help gather tubers, which are a really important dietary component of these people's lifestyle. And their grandmothers are busy doing that so that their mothers can breastfeed their children. This whole idea that grandmothers are helping out with the health of their grandchildren rather than producing more children themselves. But studies have kind of been mixed on this. Some have shown this correlation when grandmothers tend to live closer to their grandchildren or when grandmothers live longer, their grandchildren tend to do better in life, health-wise and longevity-wise. But other studies haven't shown this correlation. So in this new study, researchers said, is there a way to really disentangle all this data and figure out if there actually is this real correlation between grandmothers and the health of their grandchildren?
Where's all the data coming from?
Well, what the researchers did was they really drilled down into the genetics, and they looked at the sex-linked X chromosome. Now, all of us have, if we're women, we have 2X chromosomes, and if we're men, we have an X and a Y chromosome. And so it turns out that actually not all grandchildren are related in the same way to their grandparents. So let's take this example. You have a dad, and his mother has 2X chromosomes. So she passes along one of those X chromosomes to the dad, who is XY. So he's got his mother's X chromosome. Now he, in turn, is going to pass that X chromosome down to his daughter. His daughter is going to get the other X chromosome from her mother. But he can't pass that X chromosome down to his son because his son is going to get his only X from his mother. And what this essentially means is this X chromosome has pretty much passed directly from grandmother to granddaughter. And that makes the granddaughter 50% related to the grandmother, at least for her sex chromosomes. But when you have the grandson now, because he didn't get this X chromosome, he's 0% genetically related to his grandmother, at least on these sex chromosomes. So as you can see, and there's a lot of intermediates when we're dealing with grandparents on the maternal line, but just for sake of simplicity, you can see that there was a lot of differences in genetic relatedness between grandmothers and their grandchildren. And so the researchers wanted to know, well, you know, if we're talking about evolution here, the grandmothers really are only going to, in an evolutionary sense, want to take care of those grandchildren or ensure the health of those grandchildren that are most genetically related to them.
The daughters of their sons.
Exactly. And that's indeed what the researchers found in this study. What they did was they looked at 7 modern-day societies and some historical societies as well. They looked at farming villages in Japan and Ethiopia and Malawi, and they also looked at some historical villages as far back as the 1600s from Germany and England. And when they compiled all this data together, they did what's called a meta-analysis. They found that paternal grandmothers were most beneficial to the survival of their paternal granddaughters and least beneficial to the survival of their paternal grandsons, while maternal grandmothers showed an intermediate effectiveness. And this all flows directly from how genetically related these grandmothers are to their grandchildren.
So if I have a daughter, then I can expect potentially some help from my mother?
Yes, but not if you have a son.
Oh, well, I'm sure she'd help out anyway.
But Rob, the important thing to remember here is that researchers don't think grandmothers are making these decisions consciously, that they don't know. They don't go, oh, grandchild X is more related to me than grandchild Y, so I'm going to take better care of grandchild X. But they think there might be something going on a sort of a more subliminal level. Maybe grandchildren that are more related to their grandmother give off some sort of scent, or they have some sort of, you know, physical resemblance to their grandmother that's very subtle, you know, that's causing these grandmothers to do more either directly or indirectly for these grandchildren than they would do for grandchildren that are less related to them.
So not deliberately.
No, not deliberately.
Okay. Well, last story then. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from why grandmothers might prefer certain grandchildren, at least subconsciously, to why we prefer white wine with fish.
Now, I thought there were some red wines that could be had with fish.
Well, it's complicated. You may have heard the old admonition, white wine with fish, red wine with meat. It doesn't always hold true. There's certain fishes that work better with some wines than others, but it tends to hold as a general rule. And in this study, researchers were trying to figure out why. Is there something about pairing white wine with fish chemically that makes more sense than pairing red wine with fish?
So not the flavor combination, but something about the wine itself.
Something about the wine itself. And I've never had this experience, but maybe you have, Rob. The idea goes that if you pair certain red wines with fish, you get this really strong fishy aftertaste that can really wreck the meal.
Particularly with scallops.
Particularly with scallops, exactly. And so to figure out exactly what was going on here, a team of Japanese researchers recruited 7 experienced wine tasters, and they gave them 38 varieties of red wine and 26 types of white wine. And over 4 sessions, they had the volunteers drink various combinations of these wines with, as it happens, scallops. And it turns out that these tasters did have some very negative reactions with certain pairings of red wine with the scallops. And so the researchers looked at these wines that had really produced the negative reactions, and they did a chemical analysis. And the correlation they found is that the red wines that were especially high in iron were more likely to produce this fishy aftertaste with scallops than other red wines or white wines, which tended to have much lower concentrations of iron.
What's the iron doing? How's it reacting with the fish?
Well, that's what they still don't know yet. They suspect that the iron might somehow be causing the breakdown of an unsaturated fatty acid. And when this happens, that could release decaying fish smell, which would ruin any good meal. But they're not sure exactly what's going on right now. They've gotten to this first step where they said it appears to be iron, which is the issue. And now the next step is to figure out, okay, what exactly is iron doing when it makes contact with scallops that's causing this unpleasant aftertaste?
So even though they haven't isolated the how, they're able to stop at this point and say, we think it's the iron.
Exactly. But if you look at the comments on this article from our readers, there's a lot of very strong opinions about just how applicable this study is to our everyday dining experience. So check that out. But as reported in the story, at least one outside expert thinks that the science is sound here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories on the most distant astronomical object ever observed. And also, just in time for Halloween, an ancient fly with a very bizarre appearance. It had a horn and three eyes on that horn. There's a neat little picture of him on the site. And on Science Insider, we've got a story about how the U.S. actually needs fewer scientists rather than more scientists, a very controversial study there, and also why science at the Department of Homeland Security isn't being peer-reviewed. So check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by American Journal Experts, the number one source for science and medical paper editing and proofreading. AJE has over 700 native English-speaking editors in various fields of study. They have helped tens of thousands of authors worldwide. Quality and customer satisfaction are their highest priorities. www.journalexperts.com. Use referral code SCIENCE to receive a 10% discount.
And that wraps up the October 30th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.